welcome to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. So if you're paying attention to the news, you know there is lots coming out of the war in Ukraine these days. Today, Russian President Vladimir Putin declared portions of eastern and southern Ukraine, up to 15% of the country, a part of Russia, following a sham referendum that was held in these occupied regions. This follows his announcement last week that 300,000 men will be drafted into the conflict, and an announcement that was met with the largest unrest seen in the country to date and causing thousands of Russians to flee the country. This attempted illegal annexation has been denounced by the UN, but also signals that Putin may be doubling down on this seven-month-old effort to invade and occupy Ukraine. But of course, Ukraine, following weeks of success reclaiming territory, shows no sign of backing down in this battle. Ukrainian President Zelensky recently reiterated that the country will not engage in peace negotiations while their sovereign territory is being annexed. And their Western support shows no signs of slowing either. While Russia has attempted to break the Western alliance with tactics like reducing and threatening access to energy, to date, that really hasn't worked. The West has reportedly committed more than $100 billion in aid to Ukraine since the war started, with a quarter of that coming from us here in the United States. And the United States has signaled continued support for Ukraine as Putin's saber rattling continues. I'm going to play a quick clip of President Biden talking about what the Russians did today with this annexation of a region of Ukraine.
The United States will never, never, never recognize Russia's claims on Ukraine's sovereign territory. This so-called referendum was a sham, an absolute sham. The results were manufactured in Moscow. The true will of the Ukrainian people is evident every day as they sacrifice their lives to save their people and maintain the independence of their country and in defense of freedom as well.
Not much give in that statement from the President of the United States about the support that the U.S. continues to give, along with other Western nations, to Ukraine as it battles against Russia. So how did we get to this moment, and where do we go from here? And importantly, what does this conflict mean, not only for Russians and Ukrainians, but for all of us around the globe? It's one thing to take this in as news of a conflict that is many, many miles away. It's another thing to think about what context it sits in and how it affects the other things that go on around the globe. So to help us put all of this in that context and answer all of the questions that are swirling around the Russian-Ukrainian war, I'm joined by Aaron Reddish, who is a history professor at Wayne State University with a specialization in Soviet and Russian history, also a frequent contributor to our show here on Detroit Today. Aaron, welcome back to Detroit Today.
Thank you for having me.
So last time you and I talked, I believe, was in the spring, in March, and things looked pretty different then, I think, than they do now. But I'd love your assessment of how different they are, why they're different, and I guess where all of the big questions about what's happening there stand now, almost 6 months later.
So it's, you know, the war has both changed a lot and also not changed at all. I guess in the spring, there were fears that Ukraine would collapse quickly, being overrun by Russia. You know, remember they got to the doorstep and into Kyiv, the capital of Ukraine. And while the Ukrainians were able to push them back, Russia actually during the summer had actually made advances, kind of slow churning advances, especially in the south, and had established kind of this corridor between Crimea and Russia. But things changed a lot just in the last month when Ukraine was able to launch this massive offensive in the east, in Kharkiv, where they captured over 2,300 square miles of land in this kind of this blitz offensive and kind of pushed Russia back on its heels. You know, there have been these sanctions that have slowly worked. And that's kind of a larger question in Russia. But, you know, the bigger thing is that it's, you know, the war in Ukraine has affected energy prices. It's affected global geopolitics. So that's kind of the broad view of where we stand now.
So I want to talk specifically about what Vladimir Putin announced this week and what that means, what happened with this referendum that he says shows that people in this particular region of Ukraine actually want to be part of Russia. But then I want to tie this back to why Putin invaded Ukraine in the first place and, of course, the long history between these two countries. This is not something that flared up this year or last. This is something that's been going on for a really long time.
Yes. So we have been expecting the referendum to happen. This was a referendum basically to justify the annexation of four regions. It's kind of the large the Donetsk region, but it's Kherson, Donetsk, Luhansk, and Zaporizhia that have historically a large population that identifies as Russian. You know, Ukraine is a multinational, a multi-ethnic country, as is Russia, which is kind of one of the tensions here. And Russia has used this used referendum as a way to justify its next plans. Obviously, it's what happened this last weekend in these four regions mirrors what happened in Crimea in 2014. But if we kind of back up, you know, Russia invaded Ukraine for a couple of reasons. In part, it's possible that they thought that NATO was going to attack Russia. That's kind of one idea. But it's this larger view that Ukraine isn't really a nation, that Ukraine should be part of Russia, or at least it should be under its tutelage, mm-hmm. that what Russia was doing was gathering the lands. And Putin has been very clear and uniform in one of this kind of part of his ideology that Russia should have jurisdiction or should be able to speak for all those who identify as Russia, as Russian, either in Russia itself or beyond. And then this is also kind of this clash between Russia and the West, according to Putin. You saw this in the speech that he just concluded.
What is it about all of this that should make people here and people around the world really care about what happens and what the outcome is? I mean, I think, as I said in the open, it's one thing to take it in as news, which it is, and it's interesting news. And certainly I think a lot of people are inspired by the Ukrainian response to the Russian invasion and are kind of eagerly awaiting news that continues to succeed. But talk about how something like this, the invasion of one nation by another, something in this region, this part of the world that has important strategic value, really does connect to us and our lives and our sense of the world and, of course, like of global interaction and hegemony.
Yeah. It's really hard when there's fighting on the, you know, over the ocean to kind of connect. But if we kind of go from the macro to the micro, you know, what's going on in Ukraine right now is the largest armed conflict in Europe since World War II. There is possibilities, although, I mean, it's the, Putin has raised the possibility of nuclear war, and that is something that should scare us. This is an issue of international norms and international law. We see in the referendum, which is a, as you said, is a sham. This is a violation of national sovereignty. And what happens there could be used to justify further violations of national sovereignty. Think China to Taiwan. There are these issues of international norms. There's also an issue of economics, what is going on in Ukraine is affecting energy prices. It's affecting global supply in the United States, but also globally, as that the global South, especially places like Lebanon, are still having problems getting food. But then if we kind of get down to the individual, you know, I think there is this beyond what we pay at the pump. There is kind of, you know, a connection, kind of this human connection, of what it would mean to have someone's home taken by an invader. The other thing is that, you know, the Detroit metropolitan area is home to a lot of Ukrainian, East European immigrants, and also those of heritage. So it's not just what's happening overseas. It could also be people who have connections, your neighbors, that there's actually kind of a human connection here.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm talking with Aaron Reddish, who is a history professor at Wayne State University with a specialization in Soviet and Russian history. He joins us from time to time to talk about issues regarding Russia and that part of the world. Right now, we're talking about the Russian invasion of Ukraine and, of course, the Ukrainian pushback to that invasion. The fact that this week, Russian Premier Vladimir Putin laid claim to a part of Ukraine because he says that the people of that region of the country want to be Russians, want to be part of Russia instead of Ukraine. We would love to hear from you during the conversation as well. What do you think about the war in Ukraine? Do you think much about it? Do you spend a lot of time thinking about what's happening so far away? But in a very important region and with a very important international rival of ours involved. Should America be involved more or less in this conflict? There is a lot of support coming from the United States and other Western countries for Ukraine as it fights against the Russian invasion. Do you think that support is appropriate? Do you think we should double down on that? Or do you think we should stay out of this matter? Also, we would love to hear from people who have direct connections to this conflict. Are you someone of Russian origin? Are you somebody of Ukrainian origin? Let us know what is going on with your family who might still be in the region, what you hear about this conflict from them. Also, let us know how you feel about it. What does this look like from afar if you're someone with roots in that part of the world? As always, the number here on the phones is 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll work you into the conversation. Before we go to listeners, Aaron, I want to go back to the parallels, I guess, between what was done in 2014 in Crimea and what's happening now in Ukraine, and why the interest in this part of the Ukraine? Like, what is it about this region that the Russians really feel as though it's got to be part of Russia? I mean, I know that there are deep ethnic ties, of course, and there are people in these regions who kind of think of themselves, I think, as Russians. But what is the other value of this? Are there other strategic values that bring the Russians back to this over and over again?
Yeah, so there are historical, cultural, and strategic reasons why Russia is interested in Ukraine, and why Ukraine is itself tied to Russia. So historically, you know, Ukraine was arguably the cradle of Russian civilization. Kievan Rus, going back 1,000 years, is where Russia actually converted to, where Eastern Orthodoxy kind of came to the lands. They share a similar language. Ukraine had been part of the Russian Empire, and there's been historically a lot of kind of cultural interconnections. A lot of Ukrainians live in Russia. A lot of Russians live in Ukraine. There's a bigger question of when did Ukrainian nationalism, or kind of the idea of the Ukrainian nation, kind of come to be? And the Kremlin has argued that this is more of a kind of fabricated or a modern conception. Ukrainians look back hundreds of years and see kind of their own Ukrainian nation that has a separate history from Russia. And Ukraine isn't alone in this, right? There are other now nations across the former Russian Empire and across the former Soviet Union that are their own nations. Crimea, which is this southern peninsula at the southern tip of Ukraine, was only, quote unquote, given to Ukraine during the Soviet Union, and it has a multinational population. And when Russia annexed Crimea in 2014 during the Ukrainian Revolution, this was very popular among Russians because they saw this land as coming home, coming back to them. Even though it was kind of part of the Ukrainian nation. The other four districts that were just seized during this, that are about to be illegally annexed by Russia, are a different story because they have always been part of this Ukrainian nation that is part of the Ukrainian Republic, and then after the fall of the Soviet Union in 1991, part of the Ukrainian nation. And there's a mix of Russian and Ukrainian speakers. It gets into a bigger question of what does this mean to be Russian? What does it mean to be Ukrainian? Because there are a lot of people, even Zelensky, right, whose first language is Russian, sure, living in Ukraine, and yet they identify as Ukrainians. And people's self-identity, national identity also change. So when Putin claims this land as Russian, or says that he is annexing these lands because to protect Russians from genocide or from ethnic discrimination, this is his own ideology talking about both Russian nationalism and denouncing or kind of pushing aside Ukrainian views of national selfhood.
Okay, we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we are going to continue this conversation with Aaron Reddish about the Soviet and Ukrainian war. We will also get to you on the phones and on social. Jim in Grosse Pointe, Mark in Redford, Anthony in Ann Arbor. We will get to you next. If you want to join them, of course, 313-577-1019 is the number here on the phones. That's 313-577-1019. We'll be right back with more Detroit Today.
WDET is your connection to what's happening in Detroit.
WDET is your place for open dialogue about the issues that impact you.
Stay in the know.
This is WDET FM,
Detroit's NPR station.
You're listening to Detroit Today on 101.9 WDET. I'm Stephen Henderson, and as always, thanks for tuning in. We've got Aaron Reddish with us today. He's a history professor at Wayne State with a specialization in Soviet and Russian history. Today, we're talking about the Russian war against Ukraine, the invasion of Ukraine by the Russians. What's happened since that happened? A lot of things have actually occurred and changed in this war, and we're talking about why it matters. Why those of us here in the United States ought to be concerned and paying attention to what's happening in the Ukraine. We want to hear from you as well during the conversation. How closely are you following the war in Ukraine? What do you think of the things that have happened? What do you think of the announcement by the Russians this week that they are annexing a part of Ukraine? Also, we would love to hear from folks who have ties to the region. I know this is an area where lots of us are here from other countries, and lots of people come from that region of the world. Tell us what you hear from people who you have still have a connection with in Ukraine or Russia. Also, let us know how that influences the way you're thinking about the war. 313-577-1019. That's 313-577-1019. That's the number on the phones. You can also go to Twitter and hashtag Detroit Today, and we'll include you that way. Let's first go to Mark in Redford. Mark, welcome to the show.
Yes, hi. Good morning, Stephen.
Hey.
Good morning, Professor Reddish. I emailed you in the past. I was thinking of taking your Soviet history class at Wayne State in the winter. But my question is, do you think Premier Putin would ever come to the diplomatic table to talk things over? I mean, in my mind, I say no, but I think back of what Khrushchev had done with Kennedy, and there was an impasse to avoid the consequences of the Cuban Missile Crisis. And Khrushchev slammed his heel at the United Nations conference in the past also. So in the back of my mind, I want to say Putin may come to the realization that there's a united effort for world peace.
Mark, really appreciate the question. Aaron, what is the role of negotiation here? I mean, I think there is a sense among Ukrainians that you don't negotiate with an invader. This was an unprovoked attack on a sovereign nation, and that the way to fight back is to push them out. At the same time, the negotiation might save lives. It might yield a more peaceful resolution to all of this. What would Putin think? But then, just as importantly, what would the Ukrainians think about the idea of negotiations?
Yeah, of course, it's a great question. I've thought about this a lot. I think that the only way for the war in Ukraine to end without regime change on either side is through negotiation or through a diplomatic settlement. And Putin actually it's all words but no action. He did say that he did just ask Zelensky to negotiate. He's said this before. Zelensky has said that Ukraine will fight until Russians are out of all Ukraine, and that includes Crimea. There were kind of this a hot piece going on after with the Minsk agreements that were able to kind of calm the war after Russia actually unofficially brought in troops after 2014. But what a peace would mean, I mean, what that negotiation would be is something that I don't quite understand. It's possible that Ukraine will continue its offenses and continue to gain land. I think that probably won't be the case, that they'll go back and forth. But if Ukraine does continue to seize land, then Putin might need to save face and sign a diplomatic come to a peace. And that's also only if there's domestic instability. On the other hand, if the Russians continue to push forward or actually to seize more land in Ukraine, then Russia might say that it has achieved its goals of taking the Donbass, and it has this land corridor, and then there's just going to be a very unsettled peace. So I'm usually a hopeful person, but I am not hopeful in this situation about what's going to happen in the next year or two.
Yeah. Again, Mark, really appreciate the call and the provocative question. Let's go next to Jim in Grosse Pointe. Jim, what's on your mind?
Stephen, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
The aspect that I want to bring up and what you're talking about, how this war impacts us personally, is this war started at the same time that the IPCC released a report saying that it was code red for humanity and we only had until 2025 to peak our emissions if we wanted to avoid 1.5 degrees Celsius in the future. And you can see what's happening with climate change down in Florida and Pakistan and all these other places now. We're only at 1.1. So how does the war impact? Well, it's not helping diplomatics. You know, we're coming up to, the COP27. I don't see how Russia is really going to participate very well. And China's already broken up relations, but talking about climate change. And then the other point is the U.S. military is the number one institutional emitter of greenhouse gases in the world. Mm-hmm. And we're increasing our military, but we're also, this war is creating an arms race worldwide. Now, to prove or to reinforce this point and trying to get the word out, myself and another veteran got arrested on climate strike day in Lansing with a bunch. We were with the coalition of Michigan peace groups. And I was wondering if the professor could say something about how he thinks this is going to impact, going into COP27 and dealing with climate change.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Great question, Jim. Thanks for the call. Go ahead, Aaron.
Yeah. So two things. One is war is never good for the environment. And we see this here that the war has destroyed forests, fields. It has, as you mentioned, kind of let out greenhouse gases. We see in the recent sabotage of the Nord Stream pipeline that this is releasing methane into the sea. It speaks to a larger issue, though, of the world's reliance on energy, that is on natural energy, gas and oil. And this war is about geopolitics, Ukrainian national sovereignty, but the language in which it speaks is about energy. For the Russian economy is propped up by its natural resources, gas and oil especially. And it is, and it dictates, Western European policy is dictated by its historical reliance on Russian gas and oil. Especially Germany had a very kind of tight connection and reliance on Russian gas. If they didn't have this, and I mean, Western Europe is much more, is much less reliant on natural energy than the United States, but it shows just the power of gas and oil here. And the winner is going to be a test. It's going to show the world how reliant they are mm-hmm. on gas and oil. And Russia knows this, as does Western Europe. So it's going to be these next few months are going to be a real a long test of what it actually means to be reliant on natural gas and oil.
Yeah. Again, Jim, really appreciate the call and the question. Let's go to Anthony in Ann Arbor. Anthony, what's on your mind?
Hello, Stephen. Just, in general, I think, I have a different opinion on this whole conflict. And specifically, you described it as an unprovoked invasion in this segment. And I just kind of disagree with that because, and if you recall, you had a photojournalist from the Washington Post on a few months ago. Mm-hmm. And he said that somebody has been shelling somebody or a group of people have been shelling a group of people. He didn't specify which groups for 8 years. So I don't know, where you think you can shell and bomb someone for 8 years and call that unprovoked or whatever happens after that.
Hmm. Well, Anthony, I mean, you've made this point before when we talk about this war, and obviously I respect your opinion. I don't know what the provocation would be for one sovereign nation invading another that would justify that invasion. I oppose it when we do it as the United States in places around the globe. So, but I do want to give Aaron a chance to answer this because he's the expert and he knows the history. Is it unfair, Aaron, to describe this as an unprovoked invasion?
It was unprovoked. The main question, though, is it was unprovoked, period. We need to look at how the Russian leadership saw it, though. Did the Russian leadership see it as unprovoked? And they, clearly people inside the Kremlin saw that what was going on in the Don was not to their liking. That is the Donetsk that they saw Russians treated unfairly, and then they also saw Ukraine moving towards NATO. I think there's a larger issue here, a bigger question that I've seen both from the far left and from the far right in the United States that opposes U.S. support for the war because they see it either as imperialist or that Russia is justified in and that Ukraine is corrupt. I think that there might be some elements of truth here. This is imperialist from the U.S., but certainly imperialist from Russia. But we also need to go, I see this as kind of a colonial or a Cold War view, that what this is a war of national, about the nation, about Ukraine defending national sovereignty as national project, mm-hmm. And Russia trying to impose its own national project through forced intervention. So this isn't just one of kind of Western imperialism. It's one of about contested ideas about nationhood, and I would say democracy.
Mm. Yeah. Okay, Aaron Reddish, history professor here at Wayne State University. It's always great to have you here with us on Detroit Today to help us understand what is going on with Russia and its interactions with other nations around the globe. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Okay, we are going to take another break, and we're going to switch subjects. We're going to talk about Digital Inclusion Week in Detroit, what that means, and why it's important. We're going to have Detroit's Director of Digital Inclusion, Joshua Edmonds, join us to talk about Digital Inclusion Week. Stay with us for more Detroit Today.